Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username SchoolSucksPodcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Derek McGill is 24 years old. He is a successful entrepreneur, writer, and freelancer. He's also a college dropout. Now, of course, that is not the reason Derek is successful. But today on the show, we'll talk about how the decision to leave school during his sophomore year certainly contributed to his achievement of success and professional fulfillment at such a young age. Here we go.
Honestly, for me, the only thing that helped was the understanding of where my parents' mindsets are coming from, and then just making the tough call to leave anyway. Right. And understand that I'm cutting off the financial faucet, but I'm going to have to do this now or I'm going to have to do it later. And my life is more important than temporary financial support from my parents. I mean, I wasn't super scared, but there are moments where it's like, wow, this is going to be definitely a lifestyle change.
Right.
But it's also going to be a motivator to go out and make up for that lost support somehow. And I would say the biggest thing that I tell people now that tends to get them over this hurdle is understanding that, look, if you recognize that your parents want to see you safe, all you need to do long term is satisfy that underlying desire. So by 6 months, 8 months out, when I was making money on my own, doing my own thing, my parents were all on board with the decision. They were very, very happy, very supportive. They hire people who don't go to college now. They don't even ask for college degrees on their new hiring stuff. They're totally, totally in favor of all of this now. And I think I just kind of had to go prove it to them in the real world.
I was talking to a young man at a party in these war days, and he asked me my thoughts. For the people, he scowled, then walked away. Told me my views are fucked. We screamed, we cried, the message has amplified.
Hey everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Today is February 28th, and this is the first of two conversations with Derek McGill. Among many other things, Derek also currently works as the director of marketing for Praxis, and it is definitely going to be a significant part of our second conversation. Today's show focuses on the whys and hows of leaving college, who should and perhaps who shouldn't be considering this, and the wisdom Derek's been able to pass on to others through this experience. In the next show, we'll talk about a very important follow-up to making such a decision, how to build your own credential in lieu of a college degree, and of course, how to use it to find exciting and fulfilling professional opportunities. Now, folks, production notes. This will be the last time during my current travels that I apologize to you for audio quality problems. It's nothing major. I just want you to know. Derek's audio is fine, except in the middle of the show, something happens. There's some sounds, like squeaky sounds. I thought it was a bird, so I didn't say anything because, you know, a man cannot control a bird. You know that old saying. Between episodes, I actually found out that it was a dog, so there's none of that in part two. But you're going to notice it at one point in the middle of the recording. So I just wanted you to know what it was so you weren't distracted by curiosity. If it bothers you, picture a clown sitting in the room next to where Derek is recording. And he's got one of those little horns. And at one point, he just decides he's going to honk every time he hears something that he thinks is really valuable for a young person who's trying to find his or her way in the world, educationally or professionally. And beyond all of Derek's professional successes, he is doing a great job of sharing and amplifying the lessons that he's learned through his blog. It's derekmcgill.com, DereqMagill. There's links to his YouTube channel there as well. Derek blogs every day, and there's a lot of really, really valuable information and insights. And it covers a variety, a wide variety of subjects. So I encourage you to check it out. I just want to politely remind you, this show exists because listeners support it. If you would like to help incentivize our production, continue to grow through 2018, and also access a bunch of sweet, sweet bonus material. Please go to patreon.com/schoolsucks and become a patron. We ask $1 per content item. Usually works out to be $7 a month, and it is tremendously helpful right now. Also, if you check the show notes for this episode, you'll see there's a variety of options for how you can help us, including a plethora of cryptocurrency options. We are growing, and this is the way that I need your support, because I refuse to make you sit there and listen to me pretend to be excited about getting new underwear in the mail, or getting boxes of junky collectibles in the mail, or boxes of poorly manufactured clothing in the mail, or whatever this company is that sends you food in the mail. You imagine getting fish in the mail? That's like something that happened in The Godfather. And I have to go through all this and sound like it's exciting and sound like it's great with a slight tone of voice that makes you just kind of wonder if somebody is standing next to me holding a gun to my head. That's not how it works here. So please go to patreon.com/schoolsucks and sign up to support us. All right, everybody, here we go. This is part one with Derek McGill. Thank you so much for listening and take care. Hey, Derek, welcome to School Sucks.
Hey, Brett, I'm tremendously excited to be here. When I first heard about your podcast, the title alone made me super excited about it. So thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. Do you remember how you first heard about us?
I think it was probably through my colleagues. If not that, it was something that was shared a while back, I think, on the Libertarian Homeschooler Facebook page. So one of those.
And you've done some listening?
Yeah. Awesome. I've listened to the ones you did with my colleagues, of course, and I've done, I think, a handful of other ones on occasion. I don't listen to a ton of podcasts because not because I don't like podcasts as a medium, but because I tend to use them as an excuse to multitask, right. And it ends up not focusing. But you know, I definitely have loved the stuff that I've listened to.
I wanted to start actually by talking about your decision to leave college, because you've been at a young age, you're what, 24, 25 years old?
24 right now, yeah.
Okay. You've been tremendously successful already 4 or 5 years out of making this decision. Talk a little bit about where you were, what you were pursuing when you decided that higher education was, no, as it's, you know, defined by culture, was no longer for you.
Yeah, so I mean, I could sort of preface this by saying that I never really wanted to go to college, frankly. Mm-hmm. I remember freshman year of high school. You know, I was public schooled. I always wanted to be homeschooled. I periodically throughout my life asked my parents if I could leave. I mean, I really did not want to be there from a very early age. Didn't want to be in the traditional school system. And I remember freshman year of high school telling my mom, you know, I don't think that I'm going to go to college. I really don't see of what value it could possibly be to me. And I'm frankly just tired of school, tired of the kind of traditional schooling system. Now, I ended up going to college anyway. The reason I went was kind of a handful of reasons. I think it's the reasons that most young people go. Your parents really, really want you to go. There's a lot of pressure from that. There's a lot of pressure from everybody around you to go. And then, you know, I did have this hope that college was going to be this really amazing intellectual experience. You know, I never really thought that it was going to be something that I needed for a job. I was totally not sold on the idea that I needed a credential to build a career. I just never really had that feeling. I think part of it was because, you know, my father is a very, very successful entrepreneur, business owner, owns a number of different companies. And kind of growing up and watching him, he didn't have a college degree. I sort of picked up the idea that, look, in the end of the day, if you want to be successful, you make something valuable and you sell it to other people. And that's it. You know, it made it feel, I guess, a little bit less scary.
Right.
I went to college, though, because it kind of pleasing my parents and because I had this hope that, you know, I haven't had a very good experience intellectually in high school outside of the stuff that I was doing on my own. I was reading a ton in high school on my own. That was great. But I thought maybe college will be that place where I'll meet other people like me. I will, you know, be able to engage with some really interesting professors. And hopefully have this awesome experience that they've been told I'll have, this really, you know, 4-year life-changing, mind-opening experience. Right. So I enrolled at the University of Michigan. I got accepted early action. I was a very good student in high school, and so I got into a number of different schools. And I started out there. I was a classics major. I was really into Latin and ancient Greek, actually, both the literature but also the language. So I was studying that basically from the very, very start. And very quickly realized that it was not going to be the rigorous experience that I thought it was going to be. I would say most of my peers were in my classes, not because they were interested in the subject, but because, for example, they took Latin in high school because that was the language that was offered at their private school, mm-hmm. and they need to continue taking it. Or because they are an engineer and they need a humanities credit, so they're in this history class and they're totally checked out and they're not doing the readings. And that was, I would say, 80-90% of the people in the classes that I was in.
Mm-hmm.
And right. when you're expected to work with these kids to review your essays, to have group discussions, to discuss the reading material and the implications of that reading material, it doesn't make for a particularly good environment. And that was sort of my experience in general across the board with you know, some exceptions here and there.
So you had some hope going into it, but from what I've read in your writing and what I've seen in some of your videos, there was another part of you that maybe knew better. Is that accurate?
Yeah. I mean, I knew from my experience in public school, you know, elementary school, middle school, high school, that the system was not geared towards this kind of stuff. And I figured that college would not be either, but I did think that maybe I'll be able to navigate it better. Maybe if I pick like classics. I was really into that, but there's another reason I picked it. One of the reasons I picked it was because I thought this is kind of something that's a bit, and I don't know what to say, eccentric. It's a bit traditionalist in a sense. Like you think of classical education and you think that, you know, it has some merits to it, or at least is a bit more rigorous than maybe a traditional public school education system. And I thought, you know, maybe if I pick this major in particular, I'll get something really, really cool and I'll be able to really, you know, surround myself with the right people. And it just wasn't the case, unfortunately. I found very quickly that it was in many ways the opposite. It really wasn't any different than any of the other things I could have been doing.
Sure. So when I talk about you knowing better a little bit, it kind of relates to another part of your background that I'm interested in. I have noticed, run in a lot of the same circles politically, philosophically. Yeah. And I'd like to hear a little bit about where that grounding came from for you and how that informs a lot of what you do, what you don't do, and your decision-making process in your life so far.
Yeah, so I think really from a very early age, I was kind of, kind of a cultural libertarian in a certain sense, an individualist libertarian. I kind of marched to my own beat a little bit. I was very against any kind of authority. I was a very difficult child, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to the credit of my parents, I'm glad they were able to deal with me to some extent. But I was very, from a very early age, just individualistic. I mean, to the, you know, nth power. And as I sort of went through middle school, I think kind of in middle school, I started listening to, kind of early middle school, started listening to conservative talk radio. That kind of got me interested into politics a little bit. And that was really, for me, the only experience that I had. But it really, right around the end of middle school, my grandma sent me a copy of Atlas Shrugged. And she wrote in the book that it would be one of the best books that I would ever read.
Interesting.
And I tried reading it and just kind of, you know, first couple pages went in, just started getting bored, really kind of went over my head. I wasn't sure what it was about. But I was at a bookstore and I saw Anthem by Ayn Rand.
Mm.
And I read that and I started reading that. I didn't stop till, it's a short book, but I didn't stop till I finished it. I read it on a Sunday morning, sat in bed, read the whole thing. Immediately asked my mom to go to the bookstore to get more Ayn Rand books. And I picked up a copy of her nonfiction, Philosophy Who Needs It. Started reading that. I read the first essay about the importance of philosophy and how it relates to, you know, man's survival as a human being on Earth. I read that, and my between those two books, my mind was completely, I mean, blown away. It was an opening to a whole new world. It was really one of the most exciting moments of my life. I read those two things and then, you know, just started looking for everything else that I could. I was looking up Ayn Rand stuff, and that introduced me to Milton Friedman stuff. I remember pretty early on finding his video on greed, where he lectures that kid on, you know, on the question of greed and its role in a civil society.
Right.
And, you know, sort of throws back this idea that the sort of collectivist, let's say political systems or actors are are somehow selfless. And he says, well, that's not necessarily the case. And, you know, found him, found, you know, Henry Hazlitt in high school, because of Ayn Rand, because she actually recommended Economics in One Lesson. Through that, found Ron Paul. And it was just this process of really just for really from middle school all the way through high school and even into college, just rabid content consumption. I was reading Frederick Bastiat, Hayek, in high school. I remember I tried to kind of as a joke, this was during the Occupy Wall Street stuff. I tried to start the 1% club and right. To kind of mess with the high school administrators. They didn't approve it, but I remember one of the requirements for membership was to do a serious deep reading of a series of books in the Austrian School of Economics and pass out Ayn Rand books on campus. So it was, you know, a really fun, intellectually awakening time. And that absolutely, absolutely laid the foundation philosophically for all of my later work and for making the choice to leave college. Mm-hmm. But also it sort of practically, I think, laid the foundation in the sense that I was reading all these things that and seeing all this stuff on YouTube that I never got exposed to in class. And right. I kept thinking to myself, why am I not being exposed to these incredible ideas? Like these are, whether you agree with them or not, these are brilliant, brilliant people. And their take on history and on law and philosophy and on human nature and psychology and ethics could inform so much of the stuff that we're discussing and reading in school. And for me, it did. And, you know, I would say it made me even a little bit cocky and arrogant in high school because I was reading this stuff and I felt like, wow, like nobody else gets it. Like, and, yep. You know, and I would, you know, get into these fiery discussions in class. And I definitely had a leg up because I was able to think a little bit more philosophically than my peers and then I had previously been able to do when I was just kind of going through the standard public school curriculum stuff. So that really woke me up to all of that.
So this individualist frame that you're now viewing the world through, or it's, I mean, you know, most of us don't have access to the world at that age. We have access to a high school, right?
Yeah.
So viewing the high school through that you know, individualist perspective that you can't escape yep. Ayn Rand without exactly. having, I guess it produces a bit of frustration for you, just to speak
be an understatement.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, high school to me, really by sophomore year, was a totalitarian force for evil. And I did everything right. I could to fight it. I mean, it really, for me, I would do drawings about, I mean, I found some old stuff the other day. I was going through some boxes with some old papers and, you know, I would do drawings talking about how high school reduces everybody to a common denominator. I would, you know, yell at the administrators for being, you know, commies. I mean, I was kind of in that stage of my life, that stage when you're really young and you're first getting the ideas and maybe you're a little bit too fiery almost.
It's a fun stage. Yep. As long as it ends. Yeah,
exactly. You got the pitchfork and everything. It's very fun. You learn to temper yourself a little bit and understand that that's not, you know, that's not necessarily the way you get what you want in life. But for me, like, yeah, high school became this truly overarching force of evil. And I started to see it increasingly as not even just high school, but really public school in general, increasingly the ways in which it controlled and dominated my life from a very early on. And I remember senior year, I gave one of the reasons I was the class president, but they didn't let me give the senior speech because they thought that I would say something kind of against the school. I remember they told me that. And so I did a senior project and my project was about the abolition of public school. That was a lot of fun. I remember, you know, my teachers were not particularly happy with it, but that was, you know, really that was where my head was at. And that's really still where my head is at.
And how did that go over? Do you remember any of the details of the reception that got?
Yeah, I remember, the kids being kind of dumbfounded, frankly.
Sure.
The kids in my class thinking like how, you know, you get that kind of classic response. I remember kind of doing the QA at the very least, which is like, you know, how are people going to learn how to read and be educated and be well-rounded? Like these kinds of questions popped up then, and they've throughout my career now in education, they have popped up time and time again. These sort of classic, how are the kids going to learn how to read? How are they going to learn how to do math? How are they going to be well-rounded? And they're always asked by people who I think, you know, in a certain sense can't read very well, aren't very well-rounded. you know, aren't really using a lot of the material they claim they value from school on a day-to-day basis. It's very interesting.
Yeah, once anything becomes cemented like that, it's hard to see the world without. I mean, people, I swear, people will be saying it about Common Core in 5 years. You know,
where
would we be without it?
Well, there's that good, I don't know if you saw the tweet by, do you know Jeff Graham?
I know the name.
Yeah, so Jeff Graham, he's, I think he's the CEO or founder of Guild Quality, is a business of ours, but he tweeted out, and it went viral, totally viral, that if we let kids start school at like 6 months old, pretty soon the schools in 5 years would be claiming that you need to go to school to learn how to walk.
Yeah,
and
oh, absolutely.
That's kind of where we're at.
So let's back up just a little bit to this part where you're talking about all of these discoveries, the frustration, maybe some negative social consequences for taking on this worldview. It's definitely been proven, though, at this point, just within 10 years of those discoveries, that also gave you a kind of clarity of purpose, a direction, a sense of self. A lot of people your age don't have, most of the kids that I worked with as a teacher or as a tutor, as a college consultant, certainly in your generation, maybe a couple years older than you are right now, it was something that was really, really lacking for a majority of these kids, having that kind of direction. And I remember reading something that you wrote where you talked about dropping out of the University of Michigan during your sophomore year because you were not, quote, finding the experience valuable towards your intellectual and professional goals. And for somebody your age, I mean, it's nice that you had a sense of what that was. I really think that that's pretty rare today.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is one of the big problems. And this was the thing that I noticed when I got to college was how few people knew why they were actually there.
So how did you know?
Well, I think those ideas that we talked about were very, very important in framing the world around that. I mentioned philosophy, who needs it? Mm-hmm. That for me woke me up to the supreme importance of ideas. The idea of having a value system, a system that you try as hard as you can to make consistent and to be able to justify on rational grounds to yourself and to others. I didn't understand the importance of that in a really concrete way until I read that essay. Mm-hmm. I read that, and that to me set me on this path of really trying to figure out what do I believe, and then how does that relate to the practical actions that I take in the real world. So for me, I consider that sort of a foundational essay in my own development, both intellectually and also sort of practically. But also, growing up, I was kind of around that culture. My father was someone who would use these kind of, cheesy kind of Dale Carnegie-esque, Napoleon Hill-esque lines, about the power of the mind and visualization and goal setting and all that kind of stuff. And, the best parts of that stuck with me as well. And I always thought, if I want to get something, I need to define what that thing is. And, in college, I didn't have 100% of a picture of where I wanted to go, but I had some ideas, and I knew those ideas were clashing with the school system. I wanted to go into business. I wanted to start a business. I wanted to be able to travel. I wanted to write and be someone who's known for his writing. Mm-hmm. I wanted to take on creative projects that I found interesting. I wanted to be financially successful. And in college, I started to realize, I'm going through these motions, but I'm not really gaining a whole lot out of it. I'm not improving my thought process because I'm my abilities as a thinker and as a communicator, because I'm spending so much time on these obtuse college essays that mean nothing to me, that are just required for my course. I'm spending time reading books that I don't agree with, that I don't even find valuable or intellectually stimulating. I'm also actively funding these ideas that in many ways I'm opposed to.
Right.
Being ridiculed in class by professors for having an opinion that is different. And, kind of the combination of those things kind of made me want to leave. And I knew that, bottom line is I've got two or three more years. I was going to probably have three after my sophomore year, probably another 3 years of college left. Mm-hmm. And I thought, these are 3 years. This is a long time. And I was looking back over the course of my life and thinking, wow, like I've been in school for, 12 years or more, and I don't feel like I've really accomplished a whole lot that's my own. All of my accomplishments, you know, I was a good student. I made the dean's list. But all of those accomplishments were things that sort of other people were bestowing upon me for following their rules.
Right.
And I thought, this clashes with my own values. You know, this is, you know, if I'm truly being consistent, staying in college is in many ways the most immoral thing that I can do, because I have this, you know, sort of radical ethical system based on, you know, the importance of the individual creating his own vision for his life.
Right. But what's clear in your work and your writing as well is that you have this incredible need to do and produce. And I picked up a really good soundbite where you said you don't like to let your interests kind of linger in study mode. And
yeah,
really, you know, in higher ed, certainly in high school, for too many kids, but also in higher education, unfortunately. I was just talking about this with Peter Gray, as he was describing to me his vision of education in the future, and people your age and younger having more of these real-world opportunities. I mean, I think kids should be having them as soon as they're ready. John
yeah.
Taylor Gatto knew that, almost 30 years ago. He was doing that with middle school kids, you know, putting them out in the world. So
yeah, there's almost no age you can, that's too early to start on something.
Right.
You know, you don't need to have a full-time job when you're six, but there's stuff that you can be doing. For me, you know, I was working at my father's business through high school. I would go in on Sundays. I would do order processing and phone calls and a bunch of other stuff. And that was very valuable. I loved that. I mean, you know, anything that I could do to get my hands in some kind of work experience was huge. In college, I was working at Pita Pit, and I experienced firsthand the dramatic increase in my ability to communicate, in my own personal happiness, and my sense of self-confidence and self-awareness through being a cashier at Pita Pit.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I would come in every day. Some days you don't feel good or you don't feel well, but you've got to talk to people. You've got to smile. You've got to be nice. You've got to take their order in a prompt way. You've got to deliver the product. You really don't have the luxury of excusing yourself like you do kind of in a more of maybe a school setting, at least the way I experienced it. And getting that experience was a huge awakening to me. Also kind of just the simple fact that, you know, I would write these essays in college and I would get an A on it, but then nobody would ever read them again. And I would think to myself, what's the purpose of this? You know, how can I scratch myself on the back for getting an A when nobody's getting value out of this? I had a very
right.
kind of traitor mindset most of my life. I mean, when I was in elementary school, I was selling those kind of Livestrong bands came out, and I would sell those similar versions to that on campus. I'd buy them on the internet with my mom's credit card, ask her to order them for $1, and then I would sell them for $5 on campus. So I had a traitor mentality kind of growing up, and through that, just really always thought, you know, my work needs to be something that's valuable, and it needs to be something that can be delivered to other people in the real world.
Yeah. I was talking in an interview recently about, you know, my experience in middle school and high school, and how I would just sit there and draw things, you know, and not just draw pictures.
Yeah.
Like, they were things that I wanted to have, like, a kind of, you know, recreational or entertainment utility. I would do architectural models of baseball stadiums that actually became pretty elaborate. I was like teaching myself how to do like three-point perspective drawing. I was real into golf, so I would design golf courses just on these interesting landscapes that I would make or see in pictures. I would draw automobiles around the time I got into cars and was getting my license. And it's interesting. Like, this is what I wanted to do because it was valuable to me.
Yes.
And I don't think at that point you had some interesting education when you were the age that I was when I was doing this. I didn't have that education. I didn't have that objectivism or Austrian economics. So I didn't really understand like value beyond my own mind. It was valuable to me. So I did it, and I knew the other stuff that was being, you know, forced in front of me was not valuable, was it certainly wasn't interesting, and I couldn't understand how it would be valuable. But this idea that, you know, other people's needs and interests will be an important mirror for you to determine what valuable work is and how you should direct your time and energy, right?
Well, yeah, exactly. And that serving their needs serves my own needs in a very important way. you know, that I can essentially be paid or, you know, to make things that I love, things that I might already be trying to do on my own.
Right. I mean, what an opportunity of this time, too, because, you know, when I was that age doing that stuff, no one ever would have had any chance of discovering it. You know, we're talking about, you know, like the 1980s, the early 1990s.
Yep.
It was just a notepad. That was all it was ever going to be. And it's really nice to think that kids who are struggling in that position today, and it sounds like, you know, you were in that position 10 or yeah. so years ago, actually have not just outlets, but the opportunities to discover this vast array of outlets that exist.
Oh, it's so awesome. And what's even better is that the schools can't stop it now.
Right.
You know, these kids are on the internet. They're being exposed to all sorts of stuff, good and bad, that they can use to hopefully enliven and enlighten their life.
Right.
And you develop this mindset, hopefully, at least, and it certainly was the case with me, that, you know, you can make anything you want. You know, the means of production, not to sound too Marxist, because I'm not that at all, but the means right. of production have gotten way cheaper. You know, one example that I use is Adobe Creative Cloud, which when I first got started using it was, I don't know, a couple $1,000s for the full suite. And now it's like $49 a month, mm-hmm. you know, and so anybody can access that and immediately get plugged into that whole world. And it's really awesome.
Right. So much of the things that are going through, we've talked about so many of the things that are going through your mind at the time you're 19, 20 years old, you're a sophomore in college. What do you ultimately do with this? Because you're a man who needs to take action, obviously. You want to make a decision. You want to, you know, leave this environment and start moving, you know, more deliberately down your own path. How does that start for you? Because obviously there needs to be a conversation with, you know, people at the school. There needs to be yeah. a conversation with parents. There's going to be disappointment. What did that look like?
Well, it was a really exciting and reckless time of my life, I would say. Mm-hmm. So I finished up freshman year, and over the summer, I wasn't planning on going back to school. I kind of told my parents, I'm done, I'm not going back. I actually enrolled in this really awesome program in Rome called the Padea Institute, and they were a sort of a spoken classical Latin program. So I went and got an apartment in Rome for 2 months or so, lived with three other guys, and we would go down to the Vatican and go all over Rome with the Pope, the Latinist to the Pope, as one of the instructors. And we would read inscriptions, and we would talk about ancient literature, and, you know, tour the sites and try to speak in Latin. It was an incredible experience. I mean, a ton of fun. And I really wasn't even planning on coming back. It was kind of my parents, I would say at the time they still had a little bit of control over me psychologically and kind of forced my hand and really wanted me to do one more semester of school.
Mm-hmm.
So I came back. I mean, that was an incredible experience. And that to me was also very eye-opening, because I saw, you know, other ways that I could find community and incredible education experiences on my own, that I could really curate this for a fraction of the cost of college.
Right.
So I came back, I enrolled in my sophomore year, decided I'm going to give it one more chance. Maybe if I up the quantity and the difficulty of my classes, take some higher level courses, maybe I'll find stuff there. And, you know, the experience was essentially the same. It didn't really change, I would say, at all. I was just much, much less patient as well, I think, with my professors. I was getting frustrated that I was in a class on the French Enlightenment, but my professor knew nothing outside of that period of history, and also seemed to know nothing about economics to be able to inform the discussions of that period of history.
Sure.
And those kinds of things just were, I think, bothering me increasingly as I matured intellectually. Around that time, I also sued the school. So I don't know if you know this. I a friend of mine and I were running the Student Libertarian Club, and we sued the school over a free speech discrimination issue.
Mm-hmm.
And actually won the lawsuit. We won $15,000 for our club, and you know, forced the university to do all sorts of new things to kind of make their policies more fair. So it was a lot of fun. That also kind of riled me up against the university. I remember they deleted my email account and a bunch of other weird things.
Are you able to talk about the details of
yeah.
what they did? Yeah, sure.
So this was right around the time there was a lot of stuff going on around the affirmative action cases. And there was going to be some big Supreme Court case that involved, once again, Jennifer Gratz from the original Gratzby-Bollinger case, which sort of ended affirmative action in the country.
Right.
And we heard that this campus club called By Any Means Necessary, which yes, is sort of a yes. radical black power group, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
I would characterize them. I mean, their name alone seems to suggest that By Any Means Necessary. I was always surprised that the school would allow a name like that on campus, but was way stricter with other things.
Right. They made a lot of news at Berkeley last year, too,
yeah.
just as a reference for people.
So they were they went down to the Supreme Court. They actually took a bus, went down to the Supreme Court and protested. And we found out that the school had given them a lot of money to do this. And we knew there was a policy on the books that said the school does not fund political events. And we thought, well, this is interesting. So what if we hosted on campus, we brought Jennifer Gratz and we hosted a anti-affirmative action event where we talked about, you know, the immorality of judging people based on race and the immorality of racial quotas and stuff like that. So we brought her in. The event was heavily protested. BAM showed up. They cracked windows. The event ended up ending early because Gratz had to leave with an armed escort. It was a crazy night. They tried to steal the camera that I used to film the events. That was another thing that kind of woke me up to college as well. I was thinking like, wow, like, are these the kinds of kids that I want to be associated with? I mean, it was crazy.
Right. And it's such a perfect stage for that because there is, you know, some protection from real world consequences.
Yeah.
We saw play out 2015, 2016, 2017. It is, there's a theater to it.
Yeah.
Very
oh,
much.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
And so, you know, at the end of that event, we the whole point of it was to ask the school for funding, to sort of call them on their hypocritical policies and see if they'd be willing to fund an event that they disagreed with, a political event that they disagreed with. They said no because we were a political event. We asked them why they funded the event By Any Means Necessary, and they told us it was a multicultural event.
Mm-hmm.
So we got a lawyer. We sued them, and they had the cave pretty quickly. It was a lot of fun, and that lawsuit wrapped up right as I was finally leaving school. So that was you know, this was all going on basically the entirety of my sophomore year. In addition to that, at the end of my first semester of my sophomore year, I had worked on the Ron Paul campaign in high school. I didn't mention that, but I had done basically phone calls for him. And, you know, basically I was from San Diego, but I was calling people in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And I got invited to go to this sort of Christmas party with him. And it was going to be during my finals.
Mm.
I asked my professors if I could take my finals early, if I could take them late, if there was something that I could do to kind of work around this system. They all kind of said no. And I made the decision that it might be more fun to meet Ron Paul than and to go to this event than to take my finals. And so I skipped all of my finals and I failed every single class. Now I was, you know, like I mentioned earlier, I was a dean's list student before, failed every single class because I skipped my finals. I went to that event in Houston and got put on academic probation. I came back the following semester to give it one more shot. Really, by then I was basically done. I just figured I'd go through the motion of one last time to see if there's anything that I can salvage from this experience. And by the end of that process, the lawsuit was wrapping up. I was sort of emotionally wiped out from the lawsuit as well as just tired of the college experience. I was just done with it. I decided, you know, I'm not going to give more money to these people. I mean, it's crazy. And I skipped my finals again. I actually never did talk with the university. I was, you know, again, this was sort of the tail end of my fiery years, I would say. And I just left and never came back. And that was it.
What was your level of certainty when you did that? Was there any voice of apprehension?
No, not at all. I mean, the only voice of apprehension in a certain sense was the feeling that my parents would try to hang it over me in some way.
Mm-hmm.
But by then I was like, you know what? I'm going out to do my own thing anyway. I don't want to live with my parents. I don't want to be financially dependent on them. And in many ways, I actually wasn't financially dependent on them anymore. I had been selling T-shirts throughout college. At various times, I was making almost $1,500 a month selling T-shirts. Mm-hmm. Through a platform called Teespring. I was also, right as I was leaving, I was fortunate enough, just kind of the stars aligned. I got a job offer to be a political campaign manager in Michigan's 8th congressional district. And so I kind of had all this stuff lined up as I was leaving. I was going to leave regardless. I didn't need to have any of this stuff. And it wasn't even stuff that I wanted to be doing, you know, long term. I just wanted to have a source of income. Mm-hmm. So no apprehension at all. This was, to such an extent that I wanted to just burn all the bridges and, just make it so, you know, the cord has been totally cut. You know, I'm not even leaving myself a backup plan.
What did it take for you to be sure after that you had made the right choice?
Yeah. So, well, I mean, immediately I was happier, I would say.
Right.
Like my sense of well-being immediately went up. I mean, just the stress, the feelings of sort of, I think that come about through contradictions in your moral code, essentially, or not living up to your ideals for yourself went away as well. The feeling of, I guess, guilt that I wasn't living up to my highest version of myself went away. The political campaign did not go as planned at all. It was just a total nightmare. But, I learned some good stuff. I made some money. And within 3 months, though, I had headed back to San Diego and was basically starting from square one. But it was really quickly that I started feeling satisfied with my decision. I guess 6 months in, by 6 months in, I was totally confident. You know, my peers were going back to school. And I was working with, by then I was working with some companies building e-commerce stores and building eBay stores, doing product photography, doing video work. And, by then I was like, this is so much better. I can't even imagine going back to school.
Right. So let's back up to the part where you're talking about, maybe not necessarily proving yourself to your parents, but persuading your parents. And let's also zoom out to some more general advice for young people who are struggling in this situation or just discovering this decision exists. And the closest I ever got, I asked if I could take a semester off to do an internship that just wasn't available. Real world experience, not available on my campus. So I actually had to take a semester off from college and move across New England to do an internship with a film company. But there's a lot of people today who are realizing that they have this choice. You've done a lot of writing. You've done a lot of advising. I think this, to a certain degree, might factor into some of the people that arrive at Praxis. What kind of general advice have you been able to abstract from your own experience?
I think there's a lot of stuff. I mean, first, I would say to recognize that your parents don't know everything, truly don't know everything, and that's okay, that there was never this moment that they just suddenly reached adulthood and they were suddenly conferred all this extra wisdom. It's just not the case. They are, human beings. They have their flaws. They have their strengths. And understanding that and how that plays into the advice that they're giving is helpful. Also, sort of understanding the economics of advice.
Mm-hmm.
I think advice has limitations, particularly when the advice is sort of cost free to the people giving it. It's very easy for people to tell you to go to college because they're not experiencing firsthand the kinds of things that you're experiencing on campus. So they truly can't get it. I think it's also important to understand that your parents, while they hopefully love you and you have a good relationship with them, they can be biased by their desire to see you safe. And that can prevent you from taking the steps necessary to be successful and happy.
Absolutely.
I think that's one of the biggest things I've realized. Parents have this sort of built-in parental bias that's very difficult for them to overcome, it seems. The other thing is, in realizing, looking back over the course of my, high school education, how so much of what I did was because, or so much of what my parents wanted me to do was because they didn't want to feel like a bad parent.
Sure.
In the eyes of everybody else. You know, there's a lot of, you know, if you think the kids have pressure to do stuff too, like parents do have pressure as well in their social circles and in their parental circles and PTA meetings and all that kind of stuff. Like parents are in constant bragging and status contests with other parents around their kids. And they don't want to be made to feel like they're failing as a parent by you taking some kind of step that other parents and other, you know, people in their lives are not going to see as a smart move.
Right.
So, you know, in my case, like by the end of high school, I had been skipping. I didn't mention this. There's so much to cover in high school. I know we don't have a ton of time, but like by the end of high school, I'd been skipping so much class. I was leaving just to go read on my own. I would skip, you know, 3, 5, 10 days at a time. Sometimes by the end of high school, I'd skipped so much class in my senior year that they sent me a letter saying, like, if I don't come X number more days, they're not going to let me graduate. And I remember, they're not going to let me walk at graduation. And I remember telling my mom, I don't care about walking at graduation. And the sense of like shame that I could see in her. I mean, it was not even about me. It was about her own personal embarrassment that she would feel if I didn't walk at graduation.
Yeah. It's hard when you're that age because you don't really have the resources to have a constructive or challenging conversation with adults about maybe some of the validity of the measurements. You know, like going from high school to college, the measurement at each, you know, age bracket is a piece of paper.
Yep, exactly. And something that happens too, that I notice all the time, like I'll be talking with parents and they'll be like, well, I like your ideas for some kids, but my kids could not do that because, you know, they can't focus on anything. All they want to do is play video games. They use these things and as evidence that the kids shouldn't be able to do their own thing or shouldn't be given more personal responsibility. I see the problems that they're pointing out as functions of not having had personal responsibility. You know, to make it like political a political analogy, it's like, you know, you use like the housing bubble as an example to say that free markets are bad, but when reality was that the housing market was caused by things that undermined the free market mechanisms that would have protected us against that. And their solution is to add more government. Well, it's kind of the same thing. The solution to problems caused by schooling is to add more schooling. I think that's a bad choice. And I think if you understand that that's the mindset that your most parents and adults in your life are approaching this problem from, you can start to make headway to move around it. Things that I did that were not particularly effective was arguing with my parents about it. It never really seemed to help. I would say even putting a plan together didn't help. I've heard that it's helped some other people, but it didn't really help them. Didn't really help me. Honestly, for me, the only thing that helped was the understanding of where my parents' mindsets are coming from, and then just making the tough call to leave anyway.
Right.
And understand that I'm cutting off the financial faucet, but I'm going to have to do this now or I'm going to have to do it later. And my life is more important than temporary financial support from my parents. And that was, I wasn't super scared, but there are moments where it's like, wow, this is going to be definitely a lifestyle change, to say the least.
Right.
But it's also going to be a motivator to go out and make up for that lost income somehow, or make up for that lost support somehow. And I would say the biggest thing that I tell people now that tends to get them over this hurdle is understanding that, look, if you recognize that your parents want to see you safe, then all you need to do long term is satisfy that underlying desire. So by 6 months, 8 months out, when I was making money on my own, doing my own thing, my parents were all on board with the decision. They were very, very happy, very supportive. They you know, hire people who don't go to college now. They don't even ask for college degrees on their new hiring stuff. They're totally in favor of all of this now. And I think I just kind of had to go prove it to them in the real world.
Right. So you're talking about proving yourself to yourself, and then what kind of extends from that becomes undeniable as far as anybody who observes you is concerned.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah, that's really so. Even with all this laid out over the last 45 minutes or so, what I've gathered about you is you're not an anti-college extremist. I've interviewed a few of them on the show. You had this experience. You recognize that this is your unique experience. But if we were just going to like try to create two categories of who is college right for and who is college wrong for, How would you sort that?
Well, I would create another classification, like, who is college right for now, given the circumstances of and the situation in the real world? Who is college right for in my ideal world long term? I don't think that college is gonna be really around long term in most cases. Like, even doctor and lawyer stuff, for example, I would say short term, if you want to be a doctor and lawyer and those kind of in fields that would require a professional certification of sorts from a third party institution, legally require it, you're going to have to do this. You're going to have to go through college and, you know, just get the most out of it that you can, and then, you know, use it as a tool to get your job. If, on the other hand, if we're speaking long term, you know, apprenticeships and things like that have a long history of being used in medicine and in law and in any other basically credentialed field you can imagine. And I think that we're going to see a big move back towards that kind of stuff, or similar stuff. So, you know, I don't really see a huge role college can play in most things long term. I think we're going to see much more a la carte approaches to education and basically across the board. I would like to see, you know, programs that you could go to specifically for engineering that would give you access to, you know, CAD and CNC machines and all sorts of other tools that you might only have access to as a young person in a college lab, and that you could be using in a coding boot camp for engineers. I think that kind of model will be more and more prevalent long term.
Right.
And I see no reason that college really needs to be around in its current form. But, you know, at the same time, I would never say 100% don't go to college. I think there's a lot of negatives that I would say at the same time, I think there's a lot of negatives going to college that are underestimated. I think you pick up a lot of bad habits in college. I think most people do at the very least. I think the incentives are misaligned when profit is not involved in a learning program of sorts.
Did you pick up any bad habits despite being fairly self-directed at that time in your life? Because I think it'd be much worse for most people who didn't have that kind of direction that you already had.
Yeah, I became more lazy, certainly. I developed this laziness because I didn't like, you know, the stuff that I was doing, and, you know, I sort of got used to sort of turning my mind off during my classes, essentially. But what you don't realize is sort of like a muscle that you don't work out, that happens to your mind too. And it becomes difficult to turn it back on. You have to habituate yourself into productivity and into creativity. And if you're spending your time in that sort of that mindset of indifference to the surroundings, you know, your classes and stuff like that, you it's very easy to become lazy. It's very easy to become apathetic. It's very easy to get used to putting in the bare minimum.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, you know, pulling myself out of that environment and just forcing myself to get into a place where I couldn't afford not to do my best work, and I couldn't afford not to be focused, was tremendously valuable.
Yeah. Because so you can really afford to not do your best work there for a long time. I pulled years.
Everybody does. I mean, you go to any college campus and the kids brag about it. It's like a symbol of status to be able to not study for your tests and to be able to, you know, sort of hack your grades without actually having to learn the material.
Well, absolutely. Well, there's that. I mean, that's the intellectual component of it, but there's also a life skills and a motivational component to it. Like, if you can put on a pair of slippers and an inside out pair of sweatpants and shuffle across a courtyard and have somebody make you an omelet, it's just not gearing you up to get out in the real world, you know?
Yes, exactly. I mean, it takes a huge willpower to be able to not have that affect you in any negative ways.
Absolutely.
And for me, it was definitely had some negative consequences. And I would say absolutely for my peers, it was way worse. So there are downsides to college. I think you should be aware of that. But that environment, I think, is systemically bad for most people. At the same time, you know, my general thought on college is, if you have a goal that cannot be satisfied without going to college, then you should go. But you should understand the opportunity cost associated with that decision. College may be valuable for some, but the question is always, in compared to what alternatives? Can
Absolutely.
You do what you want to do cheaper or faster elsewhere? Oftentimes you can. The other thing I like to say is, have you tested the career that you're going to college for? Have you tested being a doctor by interning at a doctor's office? Do you really understand what it's like to be a doctor? That's probably a better decision to do that first before you enroll in college. The other thing is, you know, this is, again, kind of an economic way of thinking, is, you know, what's the actual underlying desire you're trying to satisfy with, you know, the particular thing you're going to college for? So if you're going to college to be a doctor, is it really that you want to be a doctor, or is it that you want to help people be healthier in some way? If it's that underlying desire more than actually the concrete result of being a doctor, there's probably other things you can do too. I think there's a lot of people making a lot of headway in other, you know, alternative nutrition spaces. I think a lot of the most interesting things that have happened in health and nutrition in the last 10 years have come out of non-credentialed people. And understanding that, and understanding how you can you know, use that to build a career without having to go through the credentialed path is I think useful as well.
What kind of guidance would you be able to offer young people on a process of discovery for that? Because, you know, when I reflect on, you know, the first three decades of my life, I can see these desires that I had and how I tried to manifest them into action and then actually into some kind of product that I could actually put ultimately yeah. in front of somebody else and inform them or entertain them. And my career as a student went through many phases, and then my professional career went through many phases as well, as I tried to kind of chip away at this amorphous thing, right? It was like there was a desire, there was a need I was trying to get met, but I couldn't really find the shape of it until what I do now. You know, yeah. It was always like, it started like I wanted to study communications and be a broadcaster. And then, no, I think I can get that need met through teaching. But there were too many frustrations in both cases and too many disappointments. You know, studying communications in college and then trying to enter that field and just finding a lot of the culture of it, the aesthetics of it, really unattractive. It took me a long time and a lot of failure to find my own, to basically, you know, sculpt my own thing that was ideal for me. There was no existing job that was really going to make me happy. And I had plenty of them that made me happy for a year, that brought me a lot of professional and personal satisfaction for a year or two, but I don't know if it was outgrowing them. I don't know if I was lazy and just telling myself a story. Well, no, I do. I think it was a combination of both. I would learn things that frustrated me, that made me feel like I wasn't really being helpful, or this wasn't really the optimal way to deliver this thing. But there was also a kind of laziness that would set in after that, and it would help me tell myself a story about why I should get out. But that process went on for, you know, more than a decade in my life before I really kind of found my stride. And, you know, there's a lot more striding to do to make that the thing I want it to be. Geez, Derek, I don't even remember if there was a question.
No, well, yeah. So there was kind of about how you navigate this process.
Oh, for young people. Yeah.
Yeah. And I would say your story is, you know, quite similar to mine in many ways. I mean, I think similar to the path that most of these kids are going to have to take these days, the sort of very neat conveyor belt career path that they've been sold in school does not really exist for most people. And I think that's fine. You have to get comfortable with this process of trying a lot of different things. That's certainly been my path as well. Like I mentioned before the show, I've taken a kind of a freelancer approach to everything that I've done, a sort of a project approach. Mm-hmm. And I think that's helped me get my feet wet in a lot of different spaces that I wouldn't have gotten into and I wouldn't have understood if I had, taken a more kind of conveyor belt path. I would say number one piece of advice for kids, though, and this is sort of preparatory advice, is that don't take college debt.
Right.
If you don't know what you want to do, don't take college debt because it's going to limit your options when you figure out what you want to do. It's a monumentally bad decision, almost categorically, to do that. I mean, it's just so bad. And I've seen so many of my peers and so many of the kids that I meet on talks I give are shackled by this debt and can't afford to do the things that they want to try to do. Mm. It's awful. So avoid college debt. Number two, engage with big ideas. That's something that I wish I'd mentioned more in some of my previous writing, was the importance of that. The importance of really, you know, intellectual curiosity and continually cultivating that. For me, like we discussed kind of in the beginning of the show, I don't think I would be where I am at now if I didn't have those ideas as a foundation. And then number three is, again, like we kind of discussed, start turning your learning and the thing, you know, into some kind of active creation, even if it's a particular, a small one. You know, start writing, start a blog, start a podcast where you talk about something that you're interested in, get an internship somewhere, you know, just start grabbing onto things that you can do and putting them out into the world. And through this process, like for me, the process happens in very unpredictable ways. Like you write something and you realize, oh, I really liked writing about this, or you write something and someone messages you and gives you some kind of opportunity to write more about it. And you're like, and this starts some kind of, you know, rabbit hole that you go down for a bit, or you're working at a company as an intern and you meet a customer who ends up being a client that you can sell on doing something, some work for, or you meet a customer who's doing some interesting thing in their business and you decide that I'd like to be in that space now, and I never knew that whole thing even existed.
Right.
Or you meet a colleague who has a job and they're doing this job really well, and you're like, this seems like a neat job. I never really knew I'd want that. That's the kind of approach that I've taken. That's the approach that I try to get these young kids to take. And I think that's really the only way you can approach it now. And I would say I certainly don't feel like I've made it. You know, I love my work now. I love what I'm doing. But I look at my life in the past couple of years since leaving school, and there's been a couple of transition moments in a certain sense where I've had to make, you know, a new step to go in a different direction. And even now, you know, I think we spoke about it a little bit before the call. You know, I am kind of looking for new things too. You know, I do something for a while and I think, okay, good, I like this, but I want more. There's something more that I want, and I'm constantly in that kind of discovery mode. And I don't feel uncomfortable by it.
How would you describe that motivation? Because I find that interesting. I feel like most of my professional career worked that way, and I've been doing now, I think. Well, I mean, I do a few things, and obviously what I do is very multifaceted. But I worry, being kind of stationary in this thing, even though I have, you know, a desire for it to grow and a plan for it to grow, it feels like a comfort zone. You know, when I went out and traveled at the end of last year, and I came back, and, you know, one of the first things that I observed is so many things that I was tolerating as comfortable were intolerably uncomfortable. I could have been more conscious during the travel to understand what brought that feeling on, and I'm still working to discover that. I've written a lot about it just for myself, but it was a change. A friend of mine described it as like your own psychedelic journey without psychedelics, you know?
Yeah.
And I didn't expect it to be that. I thought a lot of the benefit of the enrichment would just come from meeting the people in the audience. But there was something about, I don't know, all that accumulated time just in the car, in silence, driving 5 hours sometimes through a desert, just in silence, just with my own thoughts, sustaining that for quite a bit of time. It was a really transformative event for me. And when I came back, like I said, there was all this new evaluation about all of these things that were just comfortable.
Yep.
Now I'm kind of worried. There's a kind of stationary nature to this, and I want to investigate that. So I would ask you, because I noticed the same thing about, Zach, who's been on my show, and a lot of young, very driven, successful people, no desire to settle. There's nothing stationary about these lives that I observe.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a couple components. I would say intellectually, I've always been really interested in the idea of like Renaissance people, mm-hmm. Renaissance man, that whole idea. I've always been attracted to that. I've been attracted to, you know, sort of being a jack of all trades, and I think the process of dropping out to sort of open my, and kind of having to build my own career without traditional certifications sort of opened my eyes to the possibilities a little bit more and made me start thinking about, you know, what is possible for me to do, you know. I built a career in marketing, and, you know, I built a career as, you know, as a public speaker, you know, speaking at conferences where I'm the only non-PhD quite often. And, you know, I realized, well, the bar, you know, there's, if I wanted to get into a new space, we can do that too. And you could use really the same similar process to do it. And so I don't know, I guess I don't know how to characterize it. I guess it lent me a sort of confidence that, you know, I can go do other things that I guess normally you would think you got to go to college for. I guess that's part of it. But so I think that I have a lot of interest, and I don't really like that feeling that I'm not scratching those interests. You know, in terms of what you were saying, that you were talking about how this feeling of being settled and stuff like that. I've experienced that a couple times over the last couple few years. There's a period where you feel like you're moving forward really fast and it's awesome and you're achieving this goal, and then you get there and it's really great. But then for some reason you settle for a bit. I've had this a couple times, and you have to consciously wake yourself out of that settled mode and force yourself to say, am I going to be happy with this 5 years down the road if this is the height of my achievement and the height of the things that I've done? Or do I need to start, you know, consciously making plans now to do something else? So for me, this happened recently. You know, I was over the last 2 years, I was traveling a ton, and giving talks all around the world. And it was a heck of a lot of fun. I mean, it was an amazing experience, but I had to come to the difficult decision last fall that, like you, I had been comfortable doing that. Like it was fun to be invited to go speak and to get paid to go speak at a university or at a conference. And, you know, I mean, I went to all these different countries. I was in four continents. It was awesome, but it's like, there's a ceiling to this.
Yeah.
And if I spend all my time doing this, even though I wanted it, like I reached a point where I'm like, I really want to get invited to these kind of venues. I want to get paid to speak. It'd be really fun to be, you know, a sort of public thinker like this. And to be able to do it without a college degree is even more fun, to be able to kind of prove that it can be done. But, you know, you reach a ceiling, and I had to make the conscious decision to start saying no. The very difficult decision. I mean, it was so hard to start actively saying no to people when they invite me to speak at places. Now, I still do some talks and stuff like that, but I really have to justify them in my mind now. They really have to be lending themselves towards a bigger goal. And if they aren't, I say no, because, you know, there's a manifestation of settling into that mode. And I didn't want to see myself, you know, 5 years down the road doing these, you know, tours at colleges, speaking to an audience of, you know, anywhere from 20 to 100 people. I just felt like I would be dissatisfied if that was the only thing I had done. But it was very hard, because it was comfortable. I could, you know, I could keep doing this. I could, you know, continue making a living. I have people, you know, around the world thank me for giving a talk. Mm. It's nice. But you know, for me, like, I think I have this kind of understanding, though, that the comfort zone is a feedback mechanism that's telling me this is not good. It's time to go do something else, or it's time to go move beyond this.
To be continued.
Come on, suits, it's time to show what's up.